here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
At Nutrafol, we don't just help your hair, we help your body grow it. Because it's never just about your hair. It can be your job or your deodorant or your lunch or just normal life. That's why our whole body approach targets the key root causes of hair thinning. Discover your root causes and why we're the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com. These statements have not been approved by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease paid for by Nutraceutical Wellness, Inc.
Now playing Open Floor.
This is Open Floor.
Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix back at it.
An NBA podcast with Sports Illustrated senior writer.
I think it's time that the world get to know
my guy Chris Mannix.
I think your opinion is shared by everyone.
And now it begins.
Now it begins.
Bang!
All right, game three is done. It's a wrap. The Celtics win. 3-0 series lead. Jovan Buha here to help me break down what is just a wild game three, Jovan. And I got my notes here in front of me, and I'm not even sure where to start. Like the first quarter where I thought Dallas missed numerous opportunities to put Boston in a bigger hole than they could have been in. The third quarter where the Celtics blew the doors off the Mavericks and, you know, eventually pulling out to a 21-point lead in the fourth, or that ridiculous comeback by Dallas that came up just short, in part because Luka Doncic does not know how to play defense without fouling. Defense altogether. So where do you start? What's your top line takeaway from this game?
Well, I think you start there with the Luka defense and Luka fouling out for the first time in the playoffs. I think that ultimately cost the Mavericks that comeback opportunity. I don't think they were going to close that out over the final 4 minutes without him. So if he doesn't foul out, and maybe that call goes a different way, or he just doesn't foul in that scenario, I think there's a chance Dallas pulls off this miraculous comeback, and we're looking at a 2-1 series where now Dallas has some momentum back. You got the Kristaps Porzingis injury, the report during the game that he might not return the rest of the finals. This point doesn't really matter. It seems like it's just a matter of the Celtics either winning it in four or winning it in five. It was a crazy game. And I remember at the beginning of the fourth quarter, I started to kind of relax and be like, okay, we're going to have a blowout on our hands. Like this will be an easy conversation. But then Dallas, I think, what was it, a 17-2 run, 19-2 run, something like that, and cut it to you know, as few as one. And then they just couldn't get over the hump at the end. So an incredible game. But this, like, that kind of second half sort of summed up the series to me of just how this has gone, where Boston has really been able to generate quality looks whenever they want. Once again, they doubled up or essentially doubled up the Mavericks in terms of 3-point attempts, in terms of threes made, and everything else was like went Dallas's way for the most part. They shot the ball similarly. They won the rebounding battle. They won the possession battle in terms of turnovers, and like they just still couldn't come out with the win. So that second half to me kind of just encapsulated the dynamics between these two teams through the first three games.
Yeah, you get to the early stage of that fourth quarter, and the story looks like it's becoming Jason Tatum breaks out. Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown have a great game. Derek White plays well. Hell, Xavier Tillman made a three. Sam Hauser got a shooting stroke back. Like, you can – the stories start to kind of print themselves, but then that comeback starts. And what I like most about that comeback is that it looked like Dallas was playing kind of a freer version of their game. Like, they weren't hunting threes early on. They made a couple, but – a lot of their offense during the first 10, 12 points of that comeback was off like Luka post-ups or Kyrie drives. Like they were playing free, and Boston was playing really tight, and it let them get back into it. And we're always going to wonder what would have happened if Luka doesn't commit two fouls in like 30 seconds that knock him out of the game. And look, I know he was pissed off at the referees for those calls, but they were fouls. Like the first one was a foul when he reached around Jaylen Brown, initiated that contact. And the second one was a foul on the floor and was a foul on review. Now, we could argue that in a situation like that, maybe the referee should just let it go. Like, but once the whistle blows, you're not going to overturn that call. He was moving. He was out of position, as he often is, and he blew that play. And he goes to the bench with 4 minutes to go, leaving Kyrie Irving out there all by his lonesome. And that was the ball game, really, right there. I mean, Kyrie made a couple of shots, but, you know, they could never get back into it. So that, to me, is always going to be kind of a big question and takeaway from this game. I did think, I don't know what you thought about Kyrie's play down the stretch. Like, you know, I tweeted out right as Luka fouled out that now it's really Kyrie versus Boston. Like, this had the potential to be Kyrie's moment, right? Like, all the talk, all the buildup. Like, now, 4 minutes to play, three-point game, this was where Kyrie Irving was going to show out. And again, he did make a couple of good shots, but I also thought he played a lot of hero ball down the stretch. No, I mean, I forget who he passed up on, but someone was open on the wing when he went to the basket for a contested layup. And that last three with Al Horford right in his face, I know he's made shots like that before, but that was a situation where I thought he could have been more aggressive in trying to move the ball around, get easier looks. What did you make of Kyrie's play kind of down the stretch?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I was looking here. He had 35, finished 13 of 28.
Great game, yeah.
So like the stat line is it was a great game. But with Luka out, you needed him to take over and take over offensively. I do think that was just the death blow to Dallas, just because if you look at like the rest of the supporting cast, like, and I think there are several things that we've seen through the first three games in terms of trends that have kind of applied to each game. But really, it was to me, like, you know, Luka finished with 27, was an efficient 11 to 27. But Kyrie and Luka, I mean, they combined for 62 points. Like, that's what you need to beat Boston. And I think that's largely the reason why this game was close. But it's the other guys. PJ Washington, you know, got hot a little bit during that run and made some shots. But and Derek Lively had a good fourth quarter. But like, outside of those two, no one else really could get anything to fall offensively. Like, they dusted off Tim Hardaway Jr. He goes 0-for-5 in 19 minutes. Derek Jones continues to be a negative from a gravity perspective. Boston is completely ignoring him. And it's gotten to the point where, like, he's turning down open threes to try and drive and then driving into traffic. And then he's not sure what to do. So like, I think this came down to more, once you took Luka off the floor, there was only one guy out there that you were afraid of. And that was Kyrie Irving. And with Boston's defense, with their ability to switch across at least 1 through 4, if not 1 through 5, depending on the ball handler, like, I mean, that their defense just, they locked in crunch time. So, you know, part of it, I think, was just Kyrie, and you kind of knew where the ball was going and what he was going to do. So I think it, again, that's like Luka fouling out. And honestly, he got away with one. If you remember, there was that kind of loose ball, fast break going in Boston's direction where he kind of decked, I believe it was Jaylen Brown, and they didn't call a foul there. And that was right in front of a ref. And like, that could have been a foul that got him out earlier. So he got away with some contact as well in the fourth. But ultimately, I think that was what swung this game.
Yeah, look, there's going to be a lot of focus on Luka, a lot of focus on Kyrie, but you brought something up. Like, the story of this series so far is that Luka and Kyrie are getting no help. Most notably, Luka getting no help, because Kyrie's had his problems in the first couple of games of the series. But the numbers, they are what they are. I mean, Jason Kidd, you know, said yesterday that he believed some of these role players would play better at home. They haven't. I mean, yeah, PJ Washington, you know, played decent down the stretch, made a couple of three-pointers, but he finishes with 12. Derek Jones Jr., 2. Daniel Gafford, 6. You mentioned Hardaway Jr. They just decide to break glass in case of emergency and roll him out there. He's 0-for-5, 0-for-3 from three-point range. Maxi Kleber has done literally nothing in this series. Nothing at all.
He's another guy turning down shots, too.
Yeah, you can't do that. I you know, Derek Lively, he played better. 11 points, 10 rebounds, made some shots down the stretch when they needed him to. So I'll give him a pass on this one. But Josh Green, you know, 1-for-1, passed up on some shots. Dante Exum didn't give him anything. Jaden Hardy didn't give him anything. Like, this is the story. Boston, even with Porzingis out of the lineup, is getting contributions from a lot of different guys. Tonight, it was their core, you know, 4 or 5. And then Hauser with 9 points off the bench. Tillman, a +9 off the bench. That was a huge question for me coming in. Once Porzingis was ruled out, I thought the Celtics would go with Cornette because they've been going with Cornette all season long. But apparently Joe Mazzulla has seen just about enough of Luke Cornette in playoff situations that he went with the more experienced, maybe sturdier guy in Xavier Tillman. And Tillman, made that corner three, which he can do. Like, that's in his bag. Made that corner three. I think he blocked Luka on one of those possessions in the second half. Like, the Celtics are getting their role players to contribute, and Dallas is not. And that, to me, is a much bigger story than the Luka and Kyrie versus Tatum and Brown stuff.
Yeah, I thought Tillman, you know, they dusted him off and he looked good. I've been a fan of his going back to his days in Memphis. And I think this is a more proper slotting of him as just like a solid backup center. But I thought, you know, Boston, like the thing kind of to your earlier point was that I thought Dallas, like in the first half, should have been up by more than they were. And yeah, it looked like they were the team playing with force and physicality. They're getting downhill. Luka was attacking Drew Holiday and Jason Tatum and going right through them, getting to the rim. And everything was looking good for Dallas. Of like, this is the blueprint to finally breaking through, winning a game, and putting the pressure back on Boston. Of now, all of a sudden, you know, can you tie the series? Going back to Boston, no Porzingis, and maybe this series flips. But to be only up by one, I believe it was at halftime, and then to have the onslaught that happened in the third quarter, where Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown just took over. Like that to me was like the halftime score was sort of like, Dallas is in trouble here, because it feels like they should be up by more than they are. And eventually, again, like the role players didn't make shots. Luka slowed down a bit and then got in that foul trouble and ended up fouling out. And Kyrie couldn't get them over the hump in crunch time. So it felt like that was a missed opportunity for Dallas, particularly in the first half. And that's kind of been the story here, is like game two, Boston didn't shoot well and Dallas couldn't find a way to pull it out. And I think Boston deserves a lot of credit for their resiliency through this series of even though they have not shot the ball great, or especially by their standards, like they've just found ways to win. And it's been the defense and the switchability with their starters and then guys making timely shots and 50-50 balls. And like, it just feels like Boston has made all the big plays through the series, and that's why they're up 3-0.
Big time second half for Jaylen Brown in this game. Big time fourth quarter for Jaylen Brown. 9 points in the fourth. Jason Tatum couldn't buy a bucket in the fourth quarter. And Jaylen Brown went out, had 9 points. I think it was 4 of 7 from the floor, 5 rebounds, made the plays you needed to make on Luka to knock him out of the game. You got to give Jaylen credit for drawing those 2 fouls on Luka. That's part of his story in the game. You know, we're you know, 1 game away from having to vote on finals MVP. I think it's pretty clear at this point, it's Jaylen Brown. Like he's been, you know, really solid from start to finish. I know Drew Holiday had a great game in game two, played well in game three as well, especially defensively. But to me, the way Jaylen Brown has played in this series, it's a breakout series for him, but a breakout postseason for him. I think there's always going to be a gap between him and Jason Tatum. But if this series closes out on Friday in Dallas or even Monday in Boston, I think we're talking about Jaylen Brown, you know, emerging as a next level star in this postseason.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think this to me, so like, I mean, we'll see how game four and potentially game five, depending on how long the series goes, play out. But this to me cemented Jaylen Brown as the front runner, like, to me, like the clear front runner for finals MVP. I think he would have to be thoroughly outplayed by Jason Tatum and or Drew Holiday in the next game or two for that to really shift. But he's been great in all three games. I mean, he was great in the Eastern Conference Finals. That's why he won the, you know, the Eastern Conference Finals MVP award. And looks like it's going to get people fodder for, you know, the Tatum hate and the criticism that he faces. But I think it's just like, I mean, again, Dallas continues to throw doubles at Jason Tatum, shift their defense toward Jason Tatum. So in terms of like how they're guarding the Celtics, it's still all shifted against Jason Tatum. And there's a certain level of attention that he just commands out there. And I think, you know, even with how poorly he shot the ball in game two, he had, you know, he partly made up for that with his assists and finding his, like, he still found ways to be effective. I mean, entering this game, he was averaging almost a triple double in the series. So I think people are going to fixate on the Tatum versus Brown and what this means for Tatum, and kind of similar to like Steph not winning finals MVP in 2015. And then that kind of following him as Golden State won multiple titles. Like, I could see that being the case here, I guess, with Tatum, but I think this is more about like Brown really taking the team and putting it on his back for stretches here. And I know he had done this during the regular season, but it was always like, this is Tatum's team, and he's the guy, and he's the first all NBA team guy, and he's the all-star, and like he's just like that dude. And he has been that guy at various points in the playoffs, but Jaylen Brown was just, it's been an incredible postseason from him. And I still think Jason Tatum is a better player, but maybe that gap is just a little bit slimmer than we had previously thought.
And look, Tatum had an outstanding first half, kept a minute with the 20 points. Then Jaylen Brown had the terrific second half, helped them pull away with the 24. So they were both necessary with this win. Is it over? Yeah. If you were a betting man,
yeah. I mean, it's over. It's over.
But do you think
it's
Dallas
over.
Can summon willpower to not get swept?
Yeah, I mean, I thought the fourth quarter was, you know, notable in that sense of just like, I mean, you're down 21 facing a 3-0 deficit. You could roll over and just say, you know, we're ready for an early summer. So, or, you know, later summer, but early in that sense. So I think Dallas could still win game four, but even if they win game four, I would suspect Boston closes this out in five. I don't see it going beyond. Like, I think it would have to be another injury or something. Like, it's just we've seen enough now where Boston's a better team, and really the one question was, entering this game they were plus 26 in Porzingis's minutes, and they had played each other even in the non-Porzingis minutes, and look, they win by seven, so now they're plus seven in those minutes. And like, it's certainly closer without Porzingis. Like, I thought, especially in the first half, you felt the lack of rim protection, the lack of that you know, long range floor spacer, and him pulling the bigs out, so you saw the impact there. But it's just Boston is a better team, and this is going to go down as a special. Like, if they win game four, they're going to go through the playoffs 16-2, which is one of the best postseason marks of all time. So like, all season they had this historic net rating that put them on par with the 2017 Warriors and 1996 Bulls. And you know, there's a lot of, is this fool's gold? Or what? And certainly there were some things along the way with injuries to key players and a lot, especially in the East. But if they go 16-2, they go 16-2, and they're putting together a historic season here.
Yeah. What is it? 10 in a row now, something like that for them. Like, the kind of stuff that we haven't seen on any Boston teams. And they've had 17 world championship teams. They've had great postseason teams. This one is going to go down as one of the very best. All right, before I let you go, the backdrop of these finals has been the Lakers coaching search, which has been one of the wildest coaching searches I have ever seen in my years covering the NBA. At first, it was the established coaches, the J.J. Reddicks, maybe. And then all of a sudden, last week, it is all Dan Hurley all the time. Now we know that Dan Hurley has turned down the Lakers and their sort of lucrative offer for him. What's the tone? What's the mood inside that Laker organization right now? Because from the outside looking in, just looks like a cluster bleep. I don't want to curse here on the pod, but it looks like a cluster bleep right now, because you have a marquee franchise with arguably the greatest player in NBA history, with a top 10, top 15 player in his prime, and nobody wants the job, or at least not a college coach that would have made, you know, double his salary, you know, theoretically, to take the job. So what is going on right now inside the Laker organization?
It's a great question that I'm not sure a lot of people, even within the organization, know right now. As I reported on my podcast a couple of days ago, what I was hearing in the fallout of all this was there was no clear plan B. A lot of people were kept in the dark in terms of their plans with Hurley. And my understanding of this was, they initially, like, you know, they fired Arvin Ham, and if you're going to fire a coach, you need a plan for who's going to be the successor. So they make their initial candidate list of, you know, X amount of coaches. These are the guys we're going to reach out to. These are the people we're interested in. And they reach out to Dan Hurley, and he is not interested at that time. And he's coming off back-to-back championships, and he's working on an extension with UConn, and that's his focus at that time. At some point over the last few weeks, they hit an impact, you know, the kind of a stalling with the contract extension, and Hurley changes his mind and all of a sudden is interested in the Lakers job. And the Lakers, 5 weeks into this process, while there's been a lot of JJ Redick buzz, they have yet to formally interview him and bring him in and interview him with Jeannie Buss and Rob Pelinka the way that they did with James Borrego and then the way that they did with Dan Hurley last week. So the and there's a lot of speculation as to why that is and if it's due to the finals and JJ calling it and he's got all these media obligations and maybe it's just a cleaner process if they go through with that post finals. But for whatever reason, they're not that far into their coaching search. And then Dan Hurley, the opportunity to interview him and pursue him falls into their lap and they go after him and they make what they feel is a competitive offer. Although I think it was a good offer, not a great offer. And I think you probably had to make a great offer to blow him away and convince him to leave UConn. So that falls through. And I think if you look at the way that the reporting played out, like I don't think the Lakers let that story get out if they're not confident that they're going to land Dan Hurley. And I think there was a sense of confidence within the building that like this is the bombshell's dropping and we're going to surprise everyone. And you thought it was going to be this guy. And now we're landing arguably the top coaching prospect in basketball right now, and this guy's won a couple national championships. He's got this cachet, and you know people were poking fun at our process the whole time, but like now we're swooping in getting Hurley. But that fell through, and now they have to circle the block with some of these candidates who, like James Borrego's deep in the process with Cleveland. He's been in there for a couple days, and he might be the ultimately their choice, at which point now you either have JJ Redick, who you've also now kind of got to do some damage control with Sam Cassell coaching in the finals. So you can't really dive deeper with him until after the finals. And then are you trying to bring in a new candidate, but then you have less than 2 weeks till the draft. So it's like the Lakers have put themselves in a corner here where if it was JJ Redick before the Dan Hurley situation, like that made sense timing wise, because it seemed like they were dragging this out through the finals. But if it wasn't, as some people have reported and indicated, then I don't really know what they were doing. And now they're just running out of time here where it's like, if it's not JJ Redick, I don't know like who it's going to be. And maybe it's Borrego, but he might just take the Cleveland job this week. So this is like a lot more questions than answers right now. And I know the Lakers are regrouping and circling back with people, but it's a tricky situation.
What's your feeling on the offer that Dan Hurley got? Because when I saw what the number was, 6 years, $70 million, like that's not nothing. It's not an insignificant offer, but it's not a blow the doors off type of offer. When the reporting has to say a top six NBA coach's salary, that tells you it's not, among the very best. We're still not in Monty Williams territory, with the Detroit Pistons from last summer. My question is always going to be is if they came in with like $80 million or $90 million, would that have been enough to lure Dan Hurley away? Because look, you can say it's twice the salary he was making at UConn, though that salary is probably going to go up in this new deal. But the reality is, as you well know, taxes in California suck, right? Like they take a lot of money out of your check, much more than they are taking out in Connecticut from Dan Hurley. So you add that up with the family ties to the Northeast, the desire to stay at UConn anyway, the desire to compete for a championship. What was it, 5 years ago now, Jovan, that the Lakers kind of lowballed Ty Lue when it came to money in years, and that cost them a coach that could have kept it, that could have been on the bench right now, could have still be coaching this team. Like I wonder if they just did it again. Did they just come in too low for a coach that may have come if they went a little bit higher?
I think so. Some of the reporting that has come out since then is that for Hurley, it was not a money thing. It was just the opportunity to go for a three-peat, and his family is based in the Northeast, his dad, and just kind of pulling his family across the coat. Now,
like,
I think
do you buy
everybody
that, though? Because
I don't fully buy that. I think everybody has a price. Yeah. And so the number that had leaked over the weekend was 8 years, $100 million. And that is and now what's funny about that is if you actually extrapolate it out, the 6 year $70 million deal extrapolated to 8 years is 8 years, $93 million. So it's not a big difference from like an annual value perspective, but 8 years, $100 million is a nice whole number. And you're hitting now, nine figures. And now you're also committing to this coach for basically a decade or a near decade. And you're saying like, you're bulletproof, you're untouchable, essentially, where even if you struggle the next couple of years and the end of LeBron's tenure doesn't go well, you are going to be here through the next 10 years or so. And we're not going to fire you and eat that money and be paying Darvin Ham and still be paying you and then be paying a third coach. So like if he got that offer, I think it would have been really hard to turn down, even if technically the annual value would have been similar. So I do think, again, like I think it's hard to say that that's a, like I've seen some people poo-poo it and say it's like a bad offer. I don't agree with that. I think anytime, like, because we also have a track record of certain college coaches coming to the NBA and not necessarily adjusting. Like, it is a significant adjustment, particularly with how you develop, how you develop players and how you deal with them. And Dan Hurley, as this passionate, fiery guy, is not going to step into that Lakers locker room and talk to LeBron James and Anthony Davis the way that he would talk to his UConn players. Like that locker room has chewed up coaching, like the past two coaches. So like, that's not going to fly. And I think the Lakers were interested in his culture setting and his ability to build out a program. But at the end of the day, if 670 was the highest they were willing to go, that's just not high enough and competitive enough in today's market. And you mentioned Monty Williams, like that kind of screwed the market, but it's just changed things. And like now that set the bar, and you've seen Eric Spoelstra, Steve Kerr, Greg Popovich, those guys are getting more money. And if you really wanted to lure Dan Hurley, you just had to offer him more.
Yeah, there's definitely a separate conversation that can be had later about whether Dan Hurley would have been a good NBA coach, because I think his basketball philosophies are great. Like, he's a brilliant basketball mind, but as you know, that's half the battle in the NBA. It's all about relationships, building relationships, sustaining relationships over an 82-game season or multiple years with players on your roster. He's a passionate, passionate guy. I don't know how that would have worked. Maybe he would have modified, probably would have. Would it have been enough? That's a separate conversation. Last thing for you. Does any of this impact LeBron's future? Like, have you been of the opinion over the last few weeks that LeBron was coming back regardless of who the Lakers hired as coach? Or do you think that all this kind of goofiness of the last couple of weeks and the fact that we're sitting here, less than 2 weeks before the draft, less than 3 weeks before the start of free agency, and the Lakers don't have a coach, do you think that has the potential to be impactful?
So I've been operating under the assumption that LeBron is returning. That was the intel that we reported at The Athletic about a month ago when they were eliminated by the Nuggets. It was just like the Lakers are prepared to offer LeBron whatever he wants. And he could either opt in and extend in August and extend up to 3 years, or he can opt out and resign for up to 3 years. And it would technically be like a 2-year extension on top of the additional player option. So the advantage of opting in and extending is he gets a few extra $X million. The advantage of opting out and resigning is he can get a no trade clause, which obviously has value for him. And if the Lakers things fall apart and they want to go in a different direction, now all of a sudden LeBron can block that with that. So
he can't be traded to Orlando, basically. Yes.
Yeah, it sounded more like he was leaning toward opting out and just resigning and taking a little bit less money, but having that no trade clause. And that was how that was going to play out. But I will say, if you're like crafting the blueprint of all the things that would have to go wrong to lead to LeBron leaving, I think we're along that path, right? Like not having a coach in place less than 2 weeks before the draft. And really, like, we're talking Wednesday night, that they're not going to have a coach by Friday. So it's almost certainly, right? So I guess it could happen, and watch it happen after I said that. But like realistically, it's going to be at least like early next week on the early side. So like, you, now you're dealing with like 7 to 10 day window to bring in a coach, like have your press conference, meet with them, start planning about the draft, start planning about free agency. The Lakers are going to have access to their 3 first round picks on draft day for the first time, and potentially have to make a big decision of, do we try and trade for a third star? Do we try and split up these picks and make a couple of smaller moves to upgrade the starting lineup? Like, they have to make some pretty important decisions here with the roster, aside from even LeBron, that it's just not a big window to have to do that within a few days. And maybe they have a favorite that they're not letting us up on. And, you know, it's similar to the Hurley situation. And maybe they've had some of those talks with that candidate, but like, barring that, they are bringing a coach in at the, not even 11th hour, like basically 11th hour and 59th minute. So it's tricky, but I think LeBron is still likely to stay. And you know, we've been told that it's likely going to be 2 more years in the NBA and 2 more years with the Lakers, and he'll likely retire as a Laker. But if you were crafting that blueprint, it feels like it's going in that direction, at least a little bit of like opening the door of, you know, we don't have a coach and we'll see what they do around the draft. And if they don't, like, you know, if he doesn't love the coach and they don't make any type of move around draft night, like that opens that door up. So, and then if he opts out, like all of a sudden, you know, Philly has cap space and there's not many suitors beyond them, but like it gets interesting. But I do think all the intel I've gotten in my sense still is just like he's going to stay. It's just a matter of opting in versus opting out and like which path he prefers.
Well, it's going to be interesting. The finals are winding down, but your beat is still barely warmed up at this point. Check out Jovan over at The Athletic, his podcast, also his YouTube channel as well. Jovan, thanks for staying up late with me, man. I appreciate you doing this.
Appreciate it, Chris.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.